Romans chapter 1. We have started with verse 18 and pointed out, or rather verse 19, and pointed out from verse 19, you begin with man in atheism. He believes in the one true God. And everything from verse 19 through verse 23 is downhill. So that really, if we would start up at the top with verse 19, it's the fact that the verse states... Am I flickering again? Would you like to say that again? You mean it's going on and off? It's a breath. All right. Brand new microphone. Second time out with it. Take off the shirt. You begin in verse 18 with pure monotheism, which says, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. And so notice, they know something about God. God is singular. This is monotheism. They know about the one true God. But as you proceed down, by the time you get to verse 23, it says, they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, birds, plural, four-footed animals, plural, crawling creatures, plural. And we've arrived all the way at the bottom of the ladder, and we are looking then at polytheism. That one point, apart from anything else we could say, says more to contradict the common viewpoint on man than anything we could ever say. Because the completely and widely accepted doctrine of evolution, which is man started in chaos and he came up to order. He came with very simple beginnings and he got complex. God says man started very high as a believer in the one true God, and he crashed. And therefore, from the standpoint of the Bible, and it does not sound popular to say, but it is nonetheless true from the perspective of Romans chapter 1, who is Plato? Who is Aristotle? The rubbish of Adam, who started very high and man went very low. So notice we've come down to the rung in the downward progression, and that's man's delusion, verse 22. Professing to be wise, they became fools. As you well know, Greece, and that would be the setting for the writing of Romans, as you well know, Greece was the home of the most brilliant thinkers of that day and really any day since. It was the home of the intellectuals. Of brilliant men, such as Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, men who in the fullest sense of the word were thinkers and they were the intellectual giants of the day. At the same time, and here's the irony, you can almost trace it out in history, the more brilliant the thinker, the deeper thy idolatry. You cannot find anything more idolatrous than Greece and Rome and Egypt. And that's where our thinkers come from. When you think of the philosophers, where does your mind go? You go right back to Greece, don't you? But isn't there something unusual that with all this brilliance was set side by side by the deepest idolatry? Why? Well, it's going to find out that man, by his own brilliance, as a matter of fact, the more brilliant he is, usually the more depraved he is in his thinking. So we had, and let's go back to it, Acts 17. Well, you see these two things sitting side by side. As Paul arrives at Athens, which would be the intellectual center of everything, you come down to verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was beholding the city full of idols. And that simply means Paul had been in idolatrous cities before, but never had he seen anything like Athens. But who is also present in the city of idols? Well, verse 18. Also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, the thinkers, the intellects, were conversing with him. And some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? Others, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him, brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is which you're proclaiming, and you're teaching strange things. And they end up with a rejection of Paul coming down to the end of chapter 17. Notice the point. The Epicureans were thinkers. The Stoics were thinkers. They were the intellects of the day. And the more they thought, the deeper the paganism. So let's note a point here. Greece was the home of the intellectuals, and also it was the home of idolatry. Man's thought process did absolutely nothing to deter that in any sense of the word. If you would take Greece and Rome and Egypt, you have in verse 23, for example, a reference to, and this is Romans 1:23, you have reference to the worship of crawling things, of four-footed beasts and so forth. And basically, I think it would be a fair summary to say, basically, the Greece was the home of deity in human form. If you look at Rome, basically, it was the, or look at Egypt, Egypt was basically deity in beast form. The cobra, the snake, the asp, all of those. If you look at Rome, Rome brings together about half and half and has deity forms in both human forms and bestial forms. Do you want to hear some real porn? You know where to go for pornography? There isn't any in Kansas City. There isn't any. If you want to go to pornography, go to the golden age of the Greek writers, and you'll see some pornography. You won't get it at the library. They don't put out much of that. Much of it's expurgated. Well, probably not now like it used to be, but much of it's expurgated. And how do we explain this? That the great thinkers, brilliant minds, were also the greatest pornographers of ancient history. I have a book. I lost it. I was going to try and bring it and show it to you. Well, at least show you the cover. And it's erotica in Greece. And it's statuary, it's artworks of unbelievable filth that you couldn't fathom. And these, again, are not artist renderings. They're photographs of archaeological finds. They're photographs of statuary. And I do not say this to be crude, but if you went to McDonald's, you wouldn't have McDonald's on the cup. You'd have a phallic symbol on the cup. And you can look through their dishware, their pottery, their vases, their artwork, and it's all pervasive with this. Why is it the more intellectual man seems to be, the more anti-God he seems to be? Well, we'll see this emerging in our context. So we come down now to the seventh or lowest rung of the ladder. They finally arrived at religion. 1:23. And in Romans 1:23, you begin, they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image made in the form of corruptible man. So, the first step was truth exchanged for error. Truth exchanged for error. And you have it in 23 very clearly. They exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for the image in the form of corruptible man. So notice, worship of man was man's first substitution for God. Worship of man. And that is his first substitution for God. The second substitution is found in the latter part of the verse, or where it says in the latter part of verse 23, the image of corruptible man, birds, and four-footed animals, crawling creatures. And if the first half is truth exchanged for error, it is right, R-I-T-E, exchanged for ritual. Right, exchanged, not for ritual, for reality, sorry, for reality. And that is the second exchange. Worship of man is the first. Worship of animals is the second. Substitution. It's the bottom of the ladder. Notice the series of exchanges. God is exchanged for man, for a bird, for a quadruped, for a reptile. Now you think, well, we're too civilized for that, and we'll come to that in a little bit. But just think back of what you know of ancient Greek and Roman and Egyptian history. And what do you see? You read page after page after page about the religion of those three nations. And it's all worship of snakes, worship of boas, worship of all sorts of animals. What happened to man? Well, this is man when he turned his back on natural revelation. Now, all of this shows forth in evidence. How do we know that man has turned his back on God? Here's the way we know. So this is evidence of God's wrath. And it's found in verses 24 through 32. Evidence of God's wrath. 24 through 32. Now the first important thing to note, these verses describe the response of God to man's sin. They describe God's response to man's rejection of truth. And that is all introduced by the word therefore. And we begin in verse 24. Therefore. And therefore means because of everything I've said to you. Because I made creation and it showed something about me and man said thumbs down. Because of that, the following things are going to come about and we'll look at a description of them tonight. However, let's begin with that word therefore. And take a little lesson in Bible interpretation or how to interpret accurately. Every time you see the word therefore, every therefore has a reach and a thrust. Each therefore that you ever see has two things. It has a reach and each has a thrust. Now, here's what I mean. By reach, I mean how far back. By thrust, I mean how far forward. Now, I don't know whether you mark your text or not. I do. But whether you mark it or whatever that you may do, I make it a point to mark every therefore as to reach and thrust. So, I have in my own text, and let's pretend that this begins at verse 18, and we're now down to verse 24, and then we're going to go through to verse 27. And in 24, you've got a therefore. And I put beside my therefore, in parenthesis, 118. And / 127. 118, for my marking purposes, marks the reach, 127 the thrust. And here's what I mean. This therefore goes back and reaches to verse 18 and encircles everything in it. So the reach of the therefore How far back does it go? Is 1:18 through verse 23. Now, every therefore has got a different reach. Some of them may go back one sentence. Some of them may go back several verses. Some of them may go back a whole bunch of verses. And therefore, when I see the reach of it, in 1:18 through 23, what is it all about? It's all about what man has done to God, or what man has done with truth. 18 through 23, what man has done with truth. And Paul, with the word therefore, says, let me reach back and encircle and embrace everything in 18 through 23, and I'm going to give you the thrust of it all. And the thrust, I believe, goes down through verse 27. 24 through 27 is going to be the thrust, and the thrust will be 18 through 23, what man has done with truth, 24 through 27, what God has done in response. Now, very typical would be, and I remember hearing lots of this growing up, someone would come along and say, perhaps it was a missionary, and they would bring pictures and some description of practices in Africa of all kinds of the rings and the noses and the cutting of the flesh and the bleeding and the lancing the body and all of that. And they would always say, look, this is where the gospel has not been. Absolutely untrue. That's where the gospel has been. Heathenism is not where the gospel has not gone. Heathenism is where the gospel has gone and been rejected. So whenever we see heathen practice, heathenism is the result of rejected truth. And may we add that no person or society can ever reject truth without returning to paganism. You cannot say negative things and respond falsely to truth without being plunged into heathenism. Now, and that's true for us. The more our country rejects truth, the deeper the plunge into heathenism. The only difference with us is we get plunged into heathenism in a refined way. In a cultured way. We do it with a shirt and tie on. We do it in a respectable manner. But whenever truth is rejected, the path is always, always downward toward heathenism. That's an inflexible result. Therefore, if you see pagan practice and witchcraft in, say, South Africa, that's because once the gospel went there. And it was rejected. And because of its rejection, the darkness. So it's always, always the inevitable pattern, truth plus rejection equals darkness. Always, always, always. Truth plus rejection equals darkness. Now, if you're looking at it on a national level, how long does that take? Well, that's a relative question. It all depends on how fast truth is. Well, lots of factors. How much truth was there? How long did it take to reject the truth? Were there any instances in the way when perhaps a few people woke up to truth and the whole process got slowed down a little bit? But this is always the case. Truth plus rejection of truth equals darkness. And that's what Paul is explaining to us in Romans, this chapter of Romans. Now, if this is what man has done, therefore, here's what God has done. Notice you have a triple verb in Romans 1:24 through to the end. And if we were looking in a Greek testament, it would be paredikon autous, has given them over. But please note them in your text, verse 24. Therefore, God gave them over. Same verb, verse 26. For this reason, God gave them over. Same word, verse 28. Just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over. So you've got a triple emphasis that God gave them over. Now, what does that mean, God gave them over? I take it simply means this. God said, all right, I gave you light. You've seen the light. You've had the light, and you've said no. And now I will step back. I'll take my hands off and let your sin nature take its course. And so in 24 and following, we're seeing man's sin nature unrestrained, taking its course in these following context. Notice, by the way, in this context, what is the essence of God's wrath? Verse 18 talked about the wrath of God. What's the essence of it? It's one fairly long word, abandonment. God just stepped back and says, okay, I'll let you go your own way. You're free to sin as you will. Now, notice in your text, verse 24 and 25 form a paragraph, if you've got paragraph markers. And verse 26 and 27 also forms a paragraph. And let me ask a question and see if you can answer it. Why is it that sexual immorality is mentioned separately in each paragraph? First, verse 24. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. Sexual immorality. Then you begin the second paragraph, and it is in verse 26. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural, what we call lesbianism. And in the same way, also the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of the error, which we call homosexuality. Now, may I ask, can you read it any other way? Can you give it, can you get those words out of there for me? Can you get lesbianism out of verse 24? I mean, verse 26? Can you get homosexuality out of verse 7? Can you do it? Reading the text fairly, isn't this what Paul is saying? And it is precisely what Paul is saying. Now, my question is this. Why is sexual immorality repeated twice? Why in the paragraph of 24 and 25, and then again in the paragraph of 26 and 27? And you could say, well, it's just repetition. Well, if it's repetition, why? So I don't think repetition is a good way to express it. I think the way to express it is simply this. There were two kinds of immorality practiced in the Roman Empire of Paul's time. First, the kind in verse 24. And second, the kind in verse 26 and 27. Both of them talk about sexual immorality, but why twice? I think the reason is this. Verse 24 is cultic immorality. And we'll fill in that background for you. Cultic immorality. And 26 and 27 is personal immorality. So that it's not just repetition of the same thing two times. It's the repetition of the same thing in two different types of immorality. Now, let's list the cultic first. By cultic, I mean religious. And let me give you the way you would think, or not think, or what you would believe. First of all, we need to realize that they practiced the fertility cults. And what are the aspects of the fertility cults? What are the aspects of the fertility cults? First of all, in the fertility cults of New Testament times and Old Testament as well, they all used temple prostitutes. Now, that was not simply, what, prostitution for fun or prostitution for pleasure. This had a rationale behind it. And therefore, they used temple prostitutes, and they did so based on a definite rationale. Why would they do that? Can we explain what the rationale was. And I'll ask you at this point, can you explain what the rationale would be for making use of the temple prostitutes? And by the way, remember, as Paul writes the book of Romans, he's in Corinth. Corinth had hundreds. As a matter of fact, on Corinth, you could hardly look out your window without being reminded of the temple prostitution and the cultic thing that was there. If you visit Corinth now, you see the city down on a level, rather level plain, and you look up to the northeast, I believe, northeast, and you see this what's called Acrocorinthus. And it's a very steep face of a mountain-like thing, natural, not built, mountain-like thing that comes up steep like this and then back down into the plain on the other side. And on the peak of that Acrocorinthus, that is the peak of Corinth, was your temple, where the cultic religion was practiced. And in that temple of those times were hundreds of temple prostitutes. Now, what was this? Was this just a religion created by men to abuse women or misuse women? Is this something equivalent to a local brothel? Had nothing to do with it. It wasn't based on that rationale. It was not based on the rationale that this is good money. This is not based on the rationale that we can draw in customers as prostitution would be today. It had a definite rationale, and this was it. The processes of nature. By processes of nature, I mean the growing of crops, the increasing of the cattle, the increasing of your family size. They believe that all of those processes of nature were controlled by one thing. They believe they were controlled by the relationship of the gods and goddesses. And therefore, the better the gods and goddesses got along, the more they would procreate, the more they would procreate, the better it is for your cattle. And so if you have a herd of cattle, and if the cattle is having young, then in the mentality of Paul's day, the religious mentality, you knew that the gods and goddesses were having lots of sex. Because that is what produced. If you had rains, if you had good weather, this again was the result of the relationship of the gods and goddesses. Therefore, religion said this: we want to encourage the sexual relationship of the gods and goddesses. Therefore, to do that, we will encourage them by having sexual intercourse with the priestesses of these various gods. And therefore, the house of Aphrodite, for example, would be frequented by the worshippers who would have intercourse with the priestesses, because that would encourage the gods to have intercourse with them, and that would give you a good crop. Can you think that kinky or not? That was the thinking of the religious type thing. And therefore, you went to the temple not for pleasure. You went because you wanted to increase your family. And I increased my family by sexual intercourse with a priestess in the temple, because she is linked to the gods. And if the gods and goddesses get together, that will increase my family. And if you have a good crop, that's going to help your crops and all of this. This was the thinking. I mean, how enlightened can intelligent men be created by God in the person of Adam? That is man going down, down, down in the fullest sense of the word. So this was the thought then, and I think in verse 24 he's talking about the cultic part of this type thing. I think in 26 he gets down to the personal type thing. But right now we're thinking in a cultic mentality that was expressed sexually, but is not pure sex. Okay, therefore God gave them over to the lusts of their hearts. Now, is there any distinction? And if you think through the Bible and see the term lusts of hearts, and take the word heart and cross it out, and read elsewhere about the lusts of, you give me the word, lust of the hearts, Galatian, the lust of the what? Flesh. Same thing? Lust of the flesh, is that the same as lust of the heart? And the answer is no. There are three distinctions. The lust of the heart continues after the ability of the flesh decreases. Lust of the heart continues after the ability of the flesh to perform. It isn't too enlightening that men do not cease to lust for adultery before they can perform adultery, or longer than they can perform it. And that's one of the features of it. It comes from the heart after the flesh can no longer function. Second, the lust of the heart is deeper than the lust of the flesh. Therefore, lust of the heart is part of eternal judgment. Let me put it the way someone put it, and I'm quoting, but I don't know who I'm quoting. For those outside of Christ, eternity will be desire without fulfillment, craving without satisfaction, longing without attainment, lust without accomplishment. And therefore, ingrained is the lust for the wrong thing, but the lust for the wrong thing does not go away with the capability of the flesh to perform it. And therefore, it puts an horrible aspect on what really eternal judgment will be. We have mentioned, if you want to read real pornography, go to the Golden Age of Greece, and you will find it in abundance. Now, coming down, continuing 24, therefore God gave them over to the lust of their hearts. Now, the lust of their hearts in action is found in the word impurity. Impurity is what they thought in their hearts, now put into action. And with that, then, Paul will once again put forth his argument in verse 24, or 25. Why are men immoral? What's the basic sin? Verse 25, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Now, please note, most of our translators are satisfied to simply give us, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. However, there is a definite article in Greek. It is not a lie, it is the lie. Do you have that noted in your margin? So notice, first of all, whatever your translation will be, it definitely has, no question about it, has the definite article with it. It is there. It is not a lie. It is not lie. It is the lie. That's just part of the text. Does anyone have a translation that has that, reflects that? What do you have, Helen? You have American Standard? Oh, that's strange. Oh, in the margin. You got it in the margin. Okay, for they exchanged the truth of God for. And then you got one with a lie, and then you go out in the margin, it says, the lie. Okay, does anyone have it in the body of their text? I don't know why translators do that. It's beyond me. They all admit it's there, but they won't translate it, the lie. And there is a difference, because it simply means, then, this is the lie above all lies. There's a difference between a lie and the lie. This is above all lies. This is the lie of lies. The chief lie. Yes.
King James says who changed the truth of God into a lie. Is that more accurate?
A lie is still an indefinite
Yeah. Exchanged, not changed. It's not changed, but exchanged. In other words, changed would imply that the truth of God could be changed. And you can't change God's truth, but you can't exchange it subjectively or something. So they exchange the truth of God for the lie. Now, if it then is a lie above all lies, then what would that lie be? Well, I think the context furnishes it, doesn't it? Doesn't the context say that the lie equals this? The lie equals belief that someone or something can be worshipped in the place of God. The lie, the belief that someone or something can replace God as the object of worship. As in verse 23, God was exchanged for a reptile, for a quadruped, for a man, and for birds. And that is the lie. Isn't it wonderful that we've advanced beyond it? Never again will we be slain with the lie. But let me take you to one other place that has the same word and also has the article with it, and it's prophetic. 2 Thessalonians 2. And this is remarkable because it's going to say that the future events will prove that man has never ceased to bow to the lie. And he will once again do it. Chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians. We have the prophetic passage that talks about the coming one. Let no one say, verse 3, not let no one deceive you in any way, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first. The man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of perdition. This is all prophetic, yet to come. Who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. How different is that from Romans 1? It isn't any different at all, but it's future. Then Paul reminds him of those things, and we come down to verse 8. Then that lawless one will be revealed from the Lord, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth, bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, with all deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth. Does that sound like Romans? Man did not accept the truth, and when he does, so as to be saved. And for this reason, God will send upon a deluding influence, so that they will believe. And what is false? If you look at your margin, what do you have? The lie. You see how man has refined himself? How much better off he is now and will be in the future than he was way back then? Man is truly progressing upward, isn't he? Romans 1, they believe the lie. And with all of the progress, with all of the thinking, with all of the philosophy, with all of the reasoning, with all of the analysis, with all of the anthropology, with all of the sociology, with all of this coming into the picture, what is going to happen in the last analysis, final chapter? Men will go after the lie. And that means man is at the bottom in Romans, and man will stay there. And the idea that he is advancing beyond that is far removed from Scripture. So, let's put, this will recur, or as we put it, history will repeat itself. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now, we haven't done observations for a while, so let me do so. And I'm going to handle this a little bit differently. I think I'm coming very close to being able to say I've read everything that has been written on Romans. And sometimes you read men that will give insight that is particularly good. And let me read the verse and give the comment. And I'm putting these out because these men have said this thing so well, it really sticks. In verse 21, when it says, even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but became futile in their way of thinking or speculations. Martin Luther makes the following comment on verse 21. Where there is no faith, reason falls from one depth to another until it is totally blinded in its reasoning process. It's well put, isn't it? Where there is no faith, reason falls from one depth to another until it is totally blinded in its speculations. And again, on the general passage, I'm quoting from Bingle. A sad thing. These are such good, insightful men, such good exegetes. You can buy a book by these men in town, you know that? You could buy a rush through Romans, you know, get you through in 10 pages. But nothing of real profound significance. It's not out there. Nobody buys it. The Christian public simply is not interested in things of this sort. Bengel comments, and again, sometimes the wording that these guys use is so good. Whatever is under heaven and not under the gospel is under the wrath. That's well put. Whatever is under heaven, not under the gospel, is under the wrath. Tillotson. You remember Tillotson, last being advertised on Christian radio programs as a good book to read? Anyway. Here's a good comment. If it were only the wrath and displeasure of men that the sinner were exposed to, there might be reason enough to fear. But the wrath and vengeance of men bears no comparison with the wrath of God. Man's arm is short. His power is small. They may shoot their most poisonous arrows at us and at last kill us. But they cannot pursue us into the other world. The wrath of God has none of these limits. And that shows somebody sat down and thought. Facing the anger of men, what could be entailed? And his first thought is, they can only be angry with you until death. They can't pursue you into eternity. There is no such thing as the eternal wrath of man. There is such a thing as the eternal wrath of God, and therefore that ought to make us very sober about verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth, and we all suppress the truth. We're in deep trouble. And that's what the first part of Romans is about. On verse 24, therefore God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. And he makes a very short, but Hedinger makes a short comment. Sin is sometimes punished with sin. They rejected the light, that was sin. And how did God punish them? By driving them deeper into sin. Sin is sometimes punished with sin. Kramer, he says, although the neglect to know God is regarded by the world as no sin, and isn't that true? You imagine going to a psychologist and saying, I have a deep guilt, a sense of condemnation. I don't love God. You ever seen anyone lose sleep over that? Well, that's his comment. Although the neglect to know God is regarded by the world as no sin, or, if a sin, the least of all of them. In reality, it's the fountain of all sin. And that's a good succinct comment, is it not, on the argument of this passage. Hodge makes the comment, we must remember, the human intellect is as erring as the human heart. And he's simply saying, the heart of man being depraved cannot be discerned. Now, 11, this is mine. Stop to think. Since man continues the sin of rejecting truth, as he does, our modern culture is nothing more than heathenism adorned in respectable clothing. We've dressed it up, haven't we? Do we less today, as men and women, suppress God's truth? Do men readily admit, I see creation, there is a God? No, they don't. They argue it into the ground. But they do so, what? By lashing their bodies? No. They do so in shirt and tie. And they do so from the chair of philosophy at... Put any school you want in there. And it's done, is it not? Couple more. Oh, this is an interesting one. Reading verse 21. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks. Notice an important point. The basic sin of man is one of omission, not commission. Isn't that true? They did not honor Him as God. That's what they omitted. They did not thank Him. That's what they left out. That's called a sin of omission. And it's interesting that the theology of the New Testament and the doctrine of Paul says the root is not what you've done. What you have done is not the issue, really. The issue is what you have not done. Now, does anyone ever today get uptight over that? You ever seen anyone in deep conviction? I have not honored God. I have not been thankful to Him. They may get all worked up over something they committed. They may get all worked up over somebody they murdered in cold blood. It's not all that bad, really. What's all that bad is you didn't honor God from the perspective of Romans. If Romans doesn't shake up and correct and change every thought you've ever had, then we're failing. Because that's exactly what Roman does. Everything, I sit back here and say, I can't believe that I have been a student of the Word so many years. And in spite of all of that, it seems like my head is so messed up, I don't know up from down. And that's very often the case, and Romans should do that for us and help us, hopefully, get our thinking straightened out. Observation, human viewpoint sees man as rising from something lower to higher. Divine viewpoint teaches that man is the rubbish of something once great. I think this is a good one. The belief in evolution is a reenactment of the basic sin of all mankind, rejecting the God of creation. And you see how serious it is? Romans comes on and says, God wrote a book. And the book is called trees and flowers and everything that's out there in nature. And that book screams one message. There's a God. He's powerful. And man suppresses it. Removal of God from creation is what? A theistic evolution. And if we don't think we are submerged in human viewpoint, what have your kids heard in school from kindergarten on up? Little but that. And therefore, man, literally, in Romans, they have been done it in a pagan, heathen context. Here, we write books to eliminate God. We pursue science in many areas to eliminate God. And as I said last time, and I hope this is not cynical, it appears to me that all human education from Adam on is one massive attempt to suppress truth. And I'm talking about education apart from that is submissive to the Word of God. But by and large, it does that when we see Romans. Okay, let's turn back. I stopped at a good place. I think so. Let's put a check mark there and we'll pick up with verse 24 and how verse 25 hinges into it. And verse 25 is going to come back as another reminder that your conduct is a reflection of the suppression of the truth that we have all practiced. And our Father, we're thankful for this book. We're thankful that you love us, and we know you love us because you tell us the truth. And we are thankful for the slap that you give our own mentality. We're thankful that in a book such as Romans, you don't allow us to go on uncorrected, but you tell us the truth. And may we, by your grace, submit to that truth and learn what your view of human nature and human history is, so we'll be able to see the glory of your solution in the person of Jesus Christ, and in whose name we pray. Amen.